The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello, it's Monday the 12th of July and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Forsyth and I'm joined today by Isabel Hardman. Isabel, today is the day when the government will confirm that it is going ahead with step four of the unlocking process. We've got Sajid Javid up in the House of Commons later this afternoon and then Boris Johnson in a Downing Street press conference at 5 p.m. But this isn't the kind of triumphant moment that many imagined that the kind of the great unlocking would be. And indeed, as you were saying on Coffee House yesterday, ministers' language has become steadily more cautious over the last week. What tone do you think they're trying to strike?
So a very interesting word has crept into their media interviews, which is the word expected. Or expectation. And having gone from talking about people taking their own decisions, making their own judgments based on personal responsibility, they're now talking about what people will be expected to do. So they'll be expected to wear masks in certain settings and that there will be guidance that sets this out. And none of this was what we, well, I suppose, expected to be happening on the 19th of July. But against the backdrop of infections, which are already rising dramatically without the restrictions being lifted, ministers don't really have very much choice. They've decided, and I think public health officials agree, that this is probably the least worst time to lift those restrictions. But at the same time, that it is still a very bad time to be lifting the restrictions. And Public Health England have been really very anxious about some of the changes. So you had Dr. Susan Hopkins yesterday saying that she hoped that people wouldn't actually return to the workplace, despite the enthusiasm of some ministers to get workers back in the office, because over the next 4 to 6 weeks, it's going to be a really, really tricky time in terms of the rise of infections, the rise of hospitalisations and the ability of the NHS to cope.
Yeah, and I think on terms of returning to the office, it seems like the government is just going to move to a neutral position on that. But I think very tellingly, when you talk to people in government, there'll be no effort to get civil servants, for example, back to their office-based desk until September at the earliest. And so one of the differences from what we would have expected maybe a couple of months back is we're not going to see photos of kind of ministers rushing out to enjoy their, you know, the restored freedoms on the 19th of July. We're not going to see a big attempt to say it's now time for everyone to kind of dig their work clothes out of the back of a cupboard and get on the 7:43 commuter train. I mean, I think this is going to be, and in a way as well, I suppose, the question is, how different will life feel on the 20th of July in England than it does now?
Yeah, I agree. I think ministers are probably fortunate in that we've seen opinion polling over the weekend that shows that a lot of people are very much in favour of a continuation of the mandatory mask wearing. Now, it's unlikely that we'll get announcements saying you must carry on wearing a mask by law. But I think what this could carry into and what ministers are hoping is it will turn into a sort of peer pressure, that it will be very difficult for people to go around without a mask, say on the tube or somewhere like that, without being upbraided by other members of the public. I don't know what you think about that.
But there's another option, isn't there, which is something that Grant Shapps has kind of hinted at, which is you could have a situation where train companies, London Underground, Andy Burnham up in Manchester, you know, places basically say during peak time, wearing a mask is a condition of carriage. Now that wouldn't be a legal offence, but in the same way that there are things that you can do, I mean, that they can refuse you access to the railway or the bus. I mean, I think that is, I suspect that is where we are heading, as you say, because the rise in the number of infections is such. But I think there's that. And I think also there is another feeling, which is all of these train companies and public transport systems, they're all short of revenue because passenger numbers have been so down. And the impression I get is that they think that keeping up passenger numbers in this particular instance, masks actually makes that more likely. in that it will make people more confident if they think that if they're traveling in rush hour, a busy time, other passengers will be masked. Or, you know, it's the opposite of a situation with the theatre and cinemas, where the evidence seems to suggest that if you tell people they have to wear a mask to go, people will not be inclined to follow those. People will be inclined to say, well, I'll just stay home and wait. Obviously, these policy changes as well only apply to England. And we have had Mark Drakeford already making clear that even as Wales opens up more fully, it will go for compulsory mask wearing in certain places. Do you have any sense of where we can expect Nicola Sturgeon to land on this question?
I mean, I think based on previous form over the past year and a bit, we'll get the same sort of cautious approach, and a great deal of emphasis being placed on there being a difference in approach to the Westminster government on this. And that would be quite easy for Nicola Sturgeon to do, not least because she doesn't have, and I think this is, I don't know what you think, but I think it's overplayed a little bit with Boris Johnson's party, but he does have the concerns of his backbenchers about maintaining restrictions, which Nicola Sturgeon doesn't in the same way. And so it's easier in terms of party management for Nicola Sturgeon to go for a more cautious approach in Scotland and to mandate mask wearing for longer. I think it's interesting that mask wearing has become the sort of totemic issue here. It obviously does make a difference, but it's not making a difference, enough of a difference at the moment. And, you know, there are other measures which make much more of a difference, but unfortunately they involve restricting freedoms to a much greater extent than we are seeing at the moment. And I'm not sure that either the Welsh or the Scottish governments are going to want to go that far. They just want to show that they're a little bit different to the Westminster government on an issue which culturally is quite easy to go for.
Yeah, it's an interesting sign of where the politicians perceive public opinion to be, which is, you know, if you think case numbers are too high at the moment, you should want more restrictions, not just less easing. But no one is arguing for more of any prominence is arguing for more restrictions. Everyone is just arguing for slower or more gradual easing than that being suggested by the Prime Minister. So given that July the 19th is not going to be this is not going to be a kind of street parties moment. And I think we are both in agreement that life will not be as it was pre-COVID on July the 19th. When do you think, Isabel, I mean, and maybe this is not something that one can put a date on, but when do you think that life might feel more normal? What's your sense on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Given that we will then be heading back into the autumn-winter flu and respiratory virus season, given children will be returning to the classroom, I'm not sure we're going to see life being particularly normal for quite a long time. And I'm not sure that's something that ministers can admit to themselves just yet. But I don't know what you've been hearing. But there's a significant number of risks in the autumn, regardless, actually, of the population being vaccinated to an even greater extent than we have at the moment. There's obviously the problem where we have a sort of 10% of people who haven't been vaccinated, particularly young people who just aren't turning up. And we've got that sort of trickle of first doses when you look at the data. I don't know what you think, but my sense is that it's going to be more of an abnormal autumn and winter than we might have hoped, and that ministers might be able to admit to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the Chris Whitty view that you won't be able to be confident about normality until April next year is probably sadly true. I also think you can see this effort to encourage more young people to get vaccinated. I always think the more that vaccine passports are being talked about by government sources, the more worried they are about vaccine take-up among the young. And it's quite interesting. We've had two policies that will explicitly benefit the double jabbed. From August the 16th, double jab people won't need to self-isolate. And from the 19th, double jab people won't need to isolate after returning from an amber-less country. Then you obviously had the story in the papers at the weekend about how it might be COVID passports might be required, or a negative test, a vaccine certificate or a negative test might be required for entry to hospitality venues this winter. You know, I think in all of these policies, you can see an attempt to boost vaccine take-up among young people, because I think if you can boost vaccine take-up among young people, the hope is that you might be able to get to herd immunity without having to vaccinate children, which I think is both ethically and politically complicated. It would obviously be simpler if you could have, you know, universal, almost universal take up among over 18s and achieve herd immunity that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I guess we're also, as a country, dealing with the aftermath of last night's football, which even for those of us like me who don't tend to follow football or indeed any live sport at all, was quite a moving and nail-biting game. And unfortunately, one of the pieces of fallout from that is the amount of racist abuse that some of the players who were involved in the penalty shootout at the end have been taking on social media. James, can social media companies really say that this is out of their control?
I think this is going to just simply increase the pressure on social media companies to sort this out. I think we have seen in the way that technology companies and social media companies have dealt with child pornography, for example, that when they turn their full technical skill set to these very difficult questions, they can find a way to deal with these problems online. And I thought there was a kind of good blog today by Ross Clark on CoffeeHouse that we were discussing just before we came on, Isabel, which makes the point that, you know, a lot of this abuse, once it had started, just simply automatically deleting posts that contained certain slurs and terms, obviously it wouldn't have solved the entire problem, but would have reduced the extent of the problem. And I think that is something that we need to be on. I think we're also going to get back into that debate about anonymity in social media, whether people should be allowed to post with nobody knowing who they are. But I think there is also a need, when the people who've done this stuff are found, not just, I think that, you know, that there should be some consequences, and I mean there should be a greater willingness to take action against people. It's doing it now on social media, I don't think we should really treat as any differently from standing in the town square 30 years ago shouting this stuff. And I think that, you know, I think that it is the modern day town square, and I think that we should be prepared to take action against people who use kind of foul racist abuse on there and treat it as seriously as we would if they were standing on a street corner shouting it.
Yeah, these are people who have jobs and families and appear perfectly normal and think that they can get away with it. So I think, as you say, it can't be something that people think that they can do secretly and have no consequences at all. And it's so out of kilter with the image that the England team have managed to project over the past few weeks, you know, of a young, committed, multicultural, just really nice bunch of people that you sort of hope also that public opinion is so strongly against this kind of behaviour now that it's very difficult for people to feel they can get away with it when they're exposed for doing it in a social context, as well as in terms of their posts being deleted and criminal justice implications.
Isabel, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be back again tomorrow, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thank you.